Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Good afternoon, distinguished ladies and gentlemen. I'm honored to be here today to address such a great gathering. After all, we develop intellectually and individually by working with giants. I take this opportunity to express my gratitude to SILRAP for having given me this opportunity, and I wish to also thank Professor Morten Baxmore and the team for the effort they put in to get all of us here. Now, my presentation is The Power of Narratives, the African Union's bid to develop an alternative international criminal law narrative. Okay, that is the topic, so you know what I'm talking about. Now, firstly, I will start with two proverbs and an observation. Now, there's an old Italian proverb that says, a magician who begins to believe in their own tricks has lost his way. There's an old Russian proverb that says, if you dance with a bear too long, you risk becoming one. And the third observation is about an Australian beer called Clayton's. Now, it's called Clayton's beer, but what it is, it's a non-alcoholic, non-carbonated drink that is colored like whiskey and packaged to resemble a whiskey bottle. And the slogan used to be, the drink you have when you're not drinking. Now, hopefully, as I go through this, it will resonate, lest I fall under the influence of a typical Kenyan politician who's invited to a peace and security meeting and goes on to talk about global warming, consequences of Catalan independence and use of Twitter in campaigns, and then jumps into his turbocharged four-wheel drive and departs. One of the things is support for the international criminal, the permanent international criminal court from states and civil society on the African continent in particular was enthusiastic. Swift and widespread ratification of the Rome Statute bore witness to that. In seeking to explain why, contrary to the expectations in Rome, the court was so enthusiastically embraced by states from Africa that 34 out of 54 African countries signed up, a staggering 63%, accounting for 28% of all state parties to the ICC. Its appeal, in opposition to other international institutions, was the stance that it was not a court a la carte in dispensing justice, but rather a global justice mechanism that did not seem to be characterized by the traditional dialectics of North and South, rich and poor, first world and third world, great powers and everyone else. Essentially, the court appeared genuinely egalitarian in structure and fair in conception. However, by 1st July 2014, exactly 12 years after the Rome Statute entered into force, a total of 21 cases in 8 situations had been brought before the ICC. All of these focused on Africa. Of these 8 situations, 4 arose from state party referrals: Uganda, Democratic Republic of Congo, the Central African Republic, and Mali. 2 were the result of the UN security referrals involving states not party to the ICC, that is Sudan and Libya. And the remaining 2 situations were Kenya and Cote d'Ivoire, which were the result of the prosecutor acting on his proprio motu of self-initiative to commence the investigations. 3 years later, the story remains the same, that is after 2014, and the romance between the ICC and African countries has been souring very rapidly. As we are gathered here today, 2 days ago, Burundi became the first country to formally withdraw from the ICC treaty, and several other countries have often expressed their desire to part ways with the ICC. And of significance is that these countries, some of these countries that have voiced such a desire, are major players on the African continent. Every major event in world affairs always has had a seemingly innocuous trigger. One need only recall the Battle of Solferino in the mid-19th century that set the tempo for the Hague Conventions and the Geneva and subsequent Geneva Conventions, which formed the bedrock of contemporary international humanitarian law. One can also think of the invention of the machine gun at the end of the 19th century that set the stage for the feverish scramble for Africa, or the assassination of Australian Archduke Franz Ferdinand that lit the powder keg that spawned the First World War. Arguably, such a trigger event that ignited the flames of discontent amongst African countries towards the ICC was the indictment of Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir. In July 2008, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court alleged that the Sudanese president bore individual criminal responsibility for genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. An arrest warrant was issued for al-Bashir in March 2009, followed by a second one the following year. Reacting to the indictments handed down by the ICC, the African Union averred that the search for justice should be pursued in a way that did not impede or jeopardize the promotion of peace in Sudan. The AU was of the opinion that the process initiated by the ICC had the potential to seriously undermine efforts to address the many pressing peace and security challenges facing Sudan, leading to greater destabilization of the country and the region as a whole. The AU requested the United Nations Security Council to defer the investigation in respect of the situation in Darfur, but the United Nations did not accept. African countries were infuriated. Consequently, the AU emphatically decided not to cooperate with the ICC, asserting that, and I quote, "The AU Assembly decides that in view of the fact that the request by the African Union has never been acted upon, the AU member states shall not cooperate pursuant to the provisions of Article 98 of the Rome Statute of the ICC relating to immunities for the arrest and surrender of President Bashir." The first formal parting shots that the romance between the ICC and African countries was in trouble was manifest in the AU summit hosted in 2011 by Equatorial Guinea. Through Assembly Decision AU 363/390/17, the AU decided that member states of the African Union would not cooperate with the ICC in the execution of the warrants of arrest, especially as in targeting senior state officials, they were forming the catalyst that would derail negotiated political solutions, which they thought more apt. Subsequently, the ICC and the wider international community was riled, seeing the Sudanese president often traveling to African countries that were state parties to the Rome Statute with clear obligations to arrest and surrender him to custody, yet no action being undertaken. The ICC duly reported this to the United Nations Council. The AU openly condemned the ICC for reporting its concerns to the United Nations Security Council, that several African state parties to the Rome Statute were failing to respect their obligations by not arresting the Sudanese president, given the clear dictates of Articles 86 to 93 of the Rome Statute, imposing obligations on states to cooperate with the ICC in the investigation and prosecution of persons responsible for international crimes. And such obligations, of course, include arresting and surrendering suspects to the ICC. The African states then and now, maybe myself, think that essentially what had happened was a solution had been found, and then the court went around looking for the problem, which obviously it's idiocy, because you start with the problem and then work with the solution, not the other way around. But that's a story for another day. Now, the AU was enraged with the reports to the United Security Council and the Association of State Parties. It was as though the ICC had carried out an action tantamount to waving a red rag in front of a wounded bull. The AU's decision not to cooperate with the ICC led to the call to quicken the pace of establishing a criminal chamber within the African court to prosecute African individuals who commit international crimes in Africa. The EU's stance was that the establishment of the criminal chamber within the African court was a more effective way to address impunity in Africa through an African mechanism whereby African state officials who commit international crimes in Africa are judged by the fellow Africans in Africa, not a remote court, divorced from the very locale of the crimes it was prosecuting. The negative consequences of the ICC's role in Africa are threefold. Firstly, invasive involvement of the ICC in transitional justice on the continent as compared to other regions, given its seemingly geostationary orbit over Africa, which masks the vast extent of the incidence of international crimes in other parts of the globe. The charge famously levied by a Sudanese ambassador to the UN against the ICC, the ICC's first prosecutor, that he was a screwdriver in the workshop of double standards, resonated with many observers on the African continent, and not just within the ranks of cynical leaders, as it graphically linked deeply held and historical aversions to imperialism, foreign subjugation, and racially discriminatory conduct. Secondly, the ICC's deployment of international criminal law has tended to occur in a manner that is not as much about the reclamation of the silenced voices of victims in transitional societies in Africa as it is about other considerations in the process of redressing past criminality. Thirdly, the deployment of international criminal law by the ICC too often appears to be driven by the perpetuation of global power asymmetries and old patterns of subjugation. This undermines the legitimacy of international criminal law and transitional justice in the eyes of many African and other constituencies. Mahmoud Mamdani notes, the emphasis, I quote, the emphasis on big powers as the protectors of rights internationally is increasingly being twined with an emphasis on big powers as enforcers of justice internationally. Its name notwithstanding, the IC is rapidly turning into a Western court to try Africans. And there have been many comments, but one that immediately jumps to my mind is a senior British minister once asserting, well, if I was him, I would have said it somewhere else, that do people think that the ICC was created to ever try the Prime Minister of Britain or the President of the US? That really summed it all up, because then it meant it was a court a la carte, double standards. Now, the external aspect of justice for victims recognizes that given structural limitations of the ICC, it cannot in its own end impunity for international crimes or deliver redress to all victims. Instead, under the principle of complementarity, where state parties have primary responsibility for prosecuting and punishing perpetrators of international crimes, the ICC acts as a court of last resort. As recognized by the court and human rights jurisprudence, to effectively end impunity, it requires victim participation and provision of effective remedies that are necessary to safeguard their legitimate interests. I won't go into too many details about this, but one of the things is nobody really, the average Jane and Joe in Africa, Jane and Joe, no, the average Maogoto and Simba of Africa, first of all, don't really understand what the ICC is about. Some don't even know where it's located. Many think it's located in the US. And so there's just that disconnect. And of course, we had our own issues with it from Kenya, but I haven't been issued with an indictment yet. I hope not. And this was part of the problem because it was a given that one of the things about why it lost favor, leave alone the fact, obviously the politicians didn't want to end up there, was the imperious manner in which the then prosecutor came to Kenya, and many people thought, here we go again, because what he seemed to be doing was talking to us, not talking with us. Big difference. Talking to somebody is dictating. Talking with somebody is communicating. So this was one of the very big, and part of that, and part of what people suspected in the background, because then it was, these politicians don't da-da-da, is the recent communications that have been leaked between Moreno Ocampo and the current prosecutor. And they paint for very ugly reading, because it's very clear the politics at play, and they were trying to figure out how to save face and gracefully let the Kenyan case collapse. If you haven't seen them, just go have a look. The memos are there leaked, and it clearly shows that. Now, there are at least three fundamental bases to support the prosecution of international crimes by the African Regional Court. One, a historical necessity for such a court to prosecute crimes which are committed in Africa, but which have no prosecutorial interest to the rest of the world. Two, a treaty obligation to prosecute international crimes in Africa. And three, the existence of crimes peculiar to Africa, but over which global international criminal tribunals such as the ICC have no jurisdiction. Now, in June 2014, the African Union Assembly of Heads of State and Government meeting in Malabo, Equatorial Guinea, adopted the protocol on amendments to the protocol on the statute of the African Court of Justice and Human Rights, calling on EU member states to sign and ratify in order to enliven the court. The Malabo Protocol is a crucial legal instrument. The protocol extends the jurisdiction of the the established African Court of Justice and Human Rights to crimes under international law and transnational crimes. When it comes into force, the ACJHR will have jurisdiction to try 14 crimes, and this is where it gets interesting. The usual suspects: genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes. Then it goes on to also include the crime of unconstitutional change of government, piracy, terrorism, mercenarism, corruption, money laundering, trafficking in persons, drugs and hazardous waste, illicit exploitation of natural resources, and the crime of aggression. So as you can see, it seeks to cover some of the issues that are in many ways peculiar to Africa. A A distinct legal basis for prosecuting international crimes in Africa derives from the obligation incurred by the EU under its Constitutive Act and other treaties to prosecute crimes prescribed in those treaties. Article 4, paragraph H of the EU Act provides for the right of the Union to intervene in a member state pursuant to a decision of the Assembly in respect of grave circumstances, namely war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity, as well as any serious threat to legitimate order to restore peace and stability to the member state of the Union upon the recommendation of its Peace and Security Council. The complementary principle is obviously a very key pivot of the Rome Statute because it confers a jurisdictional relationship between the court and the state parties to that, so that the latter will always have the right to go. How much time do I have on the clock? 2 minutes. The latter will always have the time to go at a case unless, according to Article 17 and Preambula Paragraph 10 of the Rome Statute, they are unwilling or genuinely unable to investigate or prosecute a case. Argument may be made that the complementary principle of the Rome Statute does not allow regional courts and binds the ICC and its states parties in an exclusive relationship. However, to conclude, under international law, the validity or legality of a subsequent treaty may be determined by reference to a pre-existing treaty where the state parties to a treaty decide to conclude another treaty. The only requirement is that they must, to satisfy their obligations under the later treaty, do not conflict with obligations assumed under the previous treaty. Importantly, the AU is an international organization with legal personality, meaning that the obligations assumed by an EU member state under the Rome Statute, specifically with respect to complementarity, cannot apply to the Union under international law as provided for in Article 34 of the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties. That is, a treaty does not create either obligations or rights for a third party state without its consent. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.